Thank you all for being here. Happy Easter. For those of you for whom it matters, for those of you who celebrate. And it's nice to see you here this Sunday morning. I want to recognize that I am here on the campus of St. Mary's College, which occupies the ancestral lands of the Saklan tribe. And their descendants are organizing, continuously organizing into the Muwekma Ohlone tribe. I also want to encourage all of us to consider ways that we can take action and to acknowledge and heal the history of genocide and land theft, and acknowledge that the rightful stewards, the stewards of this land, are continuing to organize, and we can find ways to support them in that work. So I would like to start, or to kind of ease us into our practice with, and it's an African tradition, but I believe it may be a tradition in other cultures too, pouring libations. So in African culture, we actually believe that a person dies twice. The first time is when the last breath leaves their bodies. And the second time, or the last time, is the last time anyone speaks our name. And so we invoke our ancestors at ceremony as part of our rituals, part of our daily practice, as a means of maintaining that connection and helping us remember the foundation on which we stand, but also helping us gain strength by kind of remembering and acknowledging all of those who have come before us, ancestors of the blood, ancestors of the community, ancestors of the heart. And that's been really important for me, because it kind of opens the space to so many influential people who have really struggled and sacrificed with us and with seven generations in mind. So the practice of pouring libation is a way of calling them in, literally calling them in, speaking their names, and asking for their positive energies, for their presence and their power to help us in our work, help us continue the work. So if there are any ancestors, if there's anyone that you would like to invoke and to invite their positive energy into the space, I invite you to speak their names, and I will speak a few names of ancestors as well. And I like to pour the libation into something living, into one of my plant friends, because that helps me remember that this is a cycle, that the energy that I'm invoking comes, surrounds, uplifts me, and then I expend that energy for myself, for my community, and for those who come after me. So I will speak the name of Abba Ahmed, and with pour libation, we say Ashe. So you can feel free to unmute, and if there are any names you would like to speak, or if you would like to speak them to yourself. Any names anyone would like to call out?
Betty Monday, Bill Castleberry, Ruben Monday.
Ashe.
Ashe.
Any others?
Herminio Ortiz, Ashe.
Ashe. Elizabeth Merritt Wade, Ashe.
David Fashaw, Ashe.
Ashe.
Greg Miller, Ashe.
Ashe.
And we will wrap up with just a little bit more pouring of the water. And I give thanks, and we give thanks to all those who have come before us. And we say Ashe, Ashe, Ashe. Thanks. So as we enter into our meditation time, I'd like to invite us to settle in and engage in a bit of a body scan before our meditation. So wherever you are, and of course acknowledging our different body types, different capacities, we may, you know, different spaces that we may be in right now, But I invite you to kind of settle into whatever space you are inhabiting right now. And you may close your eyes, or you may maintain a soft gaze. And I invite you to just kind of start by feeling the energy behind your eyes. There may be a sense of throbbing, or there may be just kind of a smooth, peaceful, calm energy kind of towards the top of your head and behind your eyes. And just breathe into that energy. And then allow your attention to expand a bit and feel into maybe the lobes of your ears. As we breathe, allow your consciousness to move into your ears. How do your ears feel? You may hear a buzzing in your ears. You may hear sounds. I hear birds outside my window. And then breathing in, we might tilt our heads to the right and feel the stretch, gentle stretch on the left sides of our neck. Feel those neck and throat muscles easing, stretching just a bit. And then we might tilt our heads to the right, I'm sorry, to the left shoulder. And feel that stretch in the right side of our neck. And then we might bring our heads back to center, and then let ourselves nod. Bring your head forward if that's available to you. And feel the muscles in the back of your neck stretch. Hopefully bringing a sense of ease, bringing your attention to the work these muscles do for us. And then let's lift our heads up to the ceiling, up to the sky, and feel those throat muscles again. Feel the muscles in the back of our neck. Get some relief. And then we might bring our heads back to center. And if we, wherever we are, if we could lift our arms, lift our heads to the sky, just stretch in our seats. Or if you'd like to stand, that's fine. Just a bit of a stretch. And then we might bend our left elbow and grasp the left elbow with your right hand and just apply gentle pressure. And feel your arm, let your arm muscles stretch out just a bit. And then if we lift both hands and our head once again, and then we might bend our right arm at the elbow and grasp it with our left hand and just hold, or maybe apply just a bit of pressure and feel that stretch all the way down into our armpits. And our muscles start to wake up. And then once again, let's lift our hands to the sky, both hands, And then if you lower your right hand and just make a beautiful arc with your left hand. And just stretch into that left side body. And as you breathe, feel the breath going into the left lung. And then you might lower the left hand and raise the right hand into an arc over our heads. And again, feel that stretch down into our side bodies, down our past our ribs. And when we breathe into our right lung. And then we might lower both hands and allow our attention to expand down into our midsection, into our middle. Those muscles that we call the core, holding us up. And if it's available, we might just execute a brief stretch toward the floor. We don't have to touch the floor, but just in the direction of the ground. Feel those muscles at our waist, allowing us to bend, if that's available to us. If not, we can always just hold our attention in that middle part of our bodies. And then we can allow our attention to expand down to our feet. And we might point our toes of both feet towards us. If we bring them towards us, we might feel a sense of stretching at the back of our feet, at our Achilles, maybe into our calves. And then we might point our toes away from us, and we feel the skin and the muscles at the tops of our feet, all the way into our shins. Really just appreciating the way these bodies work, the way they fit together and the work that they do for us. And then we might just wiggle our toes, move our feet, and allow ourselves now just to settle in a bit. And so as we feel the energy that we've created flowing through our bodies just from movement and from bringing our attention to our movement, now we might resettle into a position that's comfortable for us. And as we settle, I invite you to feel, if you can, feel the movement inside our bodies. Feel the heart beating. Maybe feel the blood flowing. And as our attention continues to be expanded, we may notice sounds around us. We may notice any movement that's around us. We may notice the movements of our chest as we breathe in and out. And with this movement, as we settle, there is stillness. There is interplay between movement and stillness. As we breathe in, we may notice a brief pause at the end of the breath. As we breathe out, we may notice another pause at the end of the breath. And so we abide in this interplay between movement and stillness. And as we begin, to come out of our meditation, I invite you once again to bring your attention into your body. And if it's accessible to you, maybe to wiggle your toes and to move, wiggle your fingers. Maybe to stretch the neck, left side, right side. Lift our heads to the sky, bring them forward. And once again, appreciate the possibilities for us to abide in the space of stillness, even within movement. Namaste. Thank you, everyone, for your practice. And again, thank you for being here this morning. And I would start just by offering a bit of guidance that this talk is an offering. And as with any offering, when we make our offering, we open our hands so that it can be received. And so whatever resonates with you, I encourage you to take that and integrate it and hopefully use it in a way that's meaningful for you. And whatever does not resonate, feel free to let it flow by. There are many possible titles for this talk, but I was telling Emiko, I think it might be the first title that came to my mind is I See You. And the reason that I would title this talk I See You is because that phrase has been in my mind for several years now, for over 10 years now. So I was at a Black graduation ceremony, and the students, I was a grad student who was graduating, but I took on the role of elder because it was for undergraduate students. And so I sat on the stage, but I was offering students their diplomas. And what I heard, though, as each student crossed the stage, I heard their friends and relatives in the audience, and they would say, I see you. I see you, Tiffany. I see you, Marcus. I see you, Katrina. And I noticed this, and there was just so much. There's so much in that. There was so much love. There was so much joy and celebration. And these were students who had been at a predominantly white institution, and in that context, it is so important to be seen. It's even more important because many students feel that they're not seen. And so there was just so much in that small phrase. And I felt so grateful. And of course, these were our young people who this was just how they communicated. But I felt them. And that's another way that we communicate, right? I feel you. And that goes beyond kind of the head to the heart. And so fast forwarding, so I think that was back in 2011 when I was at that ceremony. And then fast forwarding to a few weeks ago, I'm on the campus of St. Mary's College, and we organized a project called the Community Care Project. And it's a service and advocacy campaign where we made care packages for unhoused people and engaged in advocacy around policies and services for unhoused people. And so the first part of the project was creating of the care packages. And so I brought the supplies and students. We had about 30 students, faculty and staff who had volunteered, and they came out and put the care packages together. And as I was explaining to the students, kind of orienting them to what we were doing, I explained that the project had stemmed from the desire, from my desire to just bear witness to the fact that there are people, you know, on the streets, there are people in cars that you know, in our society. And some of those people, many of those people first, you know, are experiencing suffering. And while much of that suffering might be material, much of it is also from that feeling of being invisible, from that feeling of being unseen. And so when I explained to them where the project originated, it came from me seeing unhoused people in a park. And I was actually in Oahu for a conference and realizing, well, I have these items, things that I had gotten from the store, you know, the soap and the shampoo and the towels from the hotel room. And I just thought, well, I'll just put them together. And so the first care package was just one care package, and I put them all together. And then I had a little extra cash, and so I decided to add that into. And I just went to this park that I had been jogging around for the whole time that I was at the conference. And it was really just the desire to let the people know, I see you. And I have these items, and if they would be useful for you, then I offer them to you. And so from that first care package, then our event a few weeks ago, we made 100 care packages. So we are, you know, we are multiplying. And so when we made the care packages, I also created, so we had the supplies, but I also created a separate note station, because I explained to the students that each of the care packages should have a handwritten note. And when the students asked, you know, well, what should the note say? And I said, anything that's heartfelt, anything, it can be simple, it can be, you know, brief, just something from your heart. And what we did was, so each student, we had a note writing station, about 5 students. And I've done this several times now, and I'm always so touched by how much care and attention the students put into writing these notes. The notes take the longest, because the students, they handwrite them, they want their writing to be clear, but they also want the message to be clear. And so each of the care packages had a note, and we delivered the care packages this time to an organization in Oakland called City Team Oakland. They're in Old Town Oakland, I believe. And so there were unhoused people, there were people there having lunch. And so we gave them the packages, and then we left the remainders for other people. And so one of the men who was there getting lunch, he was so touched by the note. We sat by him because they invited us to have some lunch with them. And so we did. And he was so touched. He kept showing his note to everyone in the room. And he was saying, this is great. And it was such a contrast, because I have a photo. He's such a big man, and he's holding this little note with such joy. But I asked him if it was all right for me to take a photo of him. And he said, yes. So if it's all right with you all, I would like to just show you the photo briefly. So let me share my screen. So this is the photo. So this is our friend, and this is the note. And I didn't ask to read it at the time, but you know, with the photo, I realized we could see the message. And it's so simple, but this touched him greatly. And of course, his joy touched me. I was definitely impacted by him and by this feeling. So I'll stop the share. Stop share. There we go. So again, so my reflections on this idea, you know, this very simple statement, I see you, are kind of grounded in this. And my thoughts about, you know, the fact that we all need to be seen, but in different situations, we have different needs. Different conditions arise, and in order for us to feel seen, we need sometimes we need, you know, specific aspects of the situation to be recognized. And so this also made me think of this. It's a campaign that would start. It was started back in 2014, and it's called You OK, Sis? And some of you may have heard of this. So when I heard of it, when I just heard the name, so hashtag You OK, Sis? I knew exactly what it meant, and I was so grateful for it. So the campaign was actually started by a blogger and social worker named Feminista Jones. And it was started on Twitter because it was meant to bring attention to street harassment, especially highlighting how street harassment uniquely affects Black women, because our voices are often ignored within the feminist community and within the Black community with regard to gender. And so she witnessed a man harassing a young woman who was pushing a stroller. And so she decided to intervene. And her way of intervening was to just kind of step in and ask the woman, "You okay, sis?" In front of the man, though, so that both the woman and the man would recognize that someone else sees what's going on, that someone else recognizes this behavior. And so it was meant to, on the one hand, help restore a sense of security for the woman so that she knew that someone else saw her and had her back, but it was also to let the harasser know that what he was doing did not go unnoticed. And I marveled at it because it's such a simple intervention, but it's simple and yet direct and compassionate. And there's so much kind of held within that simple question. And of course, it's not, as people of color, we experience so much suffering from white supremacy and the interlocking systems of oppression that are really that exist and support each other on a global scale. But of course, we know that it isn't only people of color who suffer from these systems. Even though white identified people reap benefits, and many times from these systems of oppression, they are unearned benefits, but we know that they also suffer from these systems. And so I like to have my books with me. And so some of you may know the book Caste by Isabel Wilkerson, but it was through her book that I first learned about this phenomenon, Depths of Despair, which is really a kind of manifestation of unseen suffering. And so I'll read a little bit just to give you some context if you haven't heard of them. So starting just before the turn of the 21st century, the death rates among middle-aged white Americans, 45 to 54, began to rise as especially the least educated succumbed to suicide, drug overdoses, and liver disease from alcohol abuse. Those were especially highlighted. And so the authors of this study, Ann Case and actual Nobel laureate Angus Deaton, they characterize these deaths as deaths of despair. And what Wilkerson writes is that in America, I'm a political scientist, and she says political scientists have given this term depth of despair. What we call it is dominant group status threat. But what it is a phenomenon where working class white people, because they need these demarcations of caste, they need to feel, you know, this sense of superiority. They need to feel like no matter how low or no matter how much suffering they experience, people of color, especially Black people, will experience more. And so what Wilkerson says is, in a psychic way, the people dying of despair could be said to be dying of the end of an illusion, an awakening to the holes in an article of faith that an inherited unspoken superiority, a natural deservedness over subordinated castes, would assure their place in the hierarchy. They relied on this illusion, perhaps beyond the realm of consciousness, and perhaps they needed it more than any other group because our society is so competitive. And so downward social mobility for them was a constant and is a constant fear. And so the end of the quote is, one might lose everything, but not whiteness. And these deaths of despair are manifestations of this feeling that those who are supposed to be, those who these people have a vested interest in conceptualizing as inferior, they are rising. And that inferiority is becoming harder and harder to maintain, that myth of inferiority. And so this phenomenon, though, just struck me as so powerful. It struck me powerfully because, again, it helped me. It helped remind me of the fact that people who identify as white suffer under white supremacy as well. And for those people to identify so closely with whiteness that they would rather in their lives than have their sense of superiority challenged, that too is suffering. I think that can clearly be seen as a source of suffering. And so Buddhist attitudes, of course, towards suffering and not self, they can be, what can happen is that when we think about this idea of, you know, the importance of seeing others and the importance of, you know, compassion, but also honesty, in bearing witness to those who are suffering, and that includes our own suffering. What we, many of us as people of color, have also experienced is that, especially in Buddhist contexts, in Buddhist sanghas, what we have often experienced is that what is called spiritual bypassing often occurs, where our suffering or the suffering that arises due to systems of oppression is overlooked, intentionally overlooked, kind of in service of a kind of Buddhist practice that wants to deny, you know, that wants to deny based in the teachings of not self, that would deny, you know, that we have, that our suffering matters, that would deny the validity of our voices when we try to articulate our suffering. And so there's a complexity there, because while the teachings of not self are important pillars of Buddhist practice, for people of color, those teachings can be turned against us, not necessarily with ill intent, but definitely with harmful impact, creating a harmful impact. And so, many of you are probably familiar, but just in, you know, for those who are not. So one of the most important Buddhist teachings is the teaching of anatta, not self. And the Heart Sutra is often kind of referred to as one of the most fundamental teachings, or foundational teaching of not self. And Thich Nhat Hanh offered an English translation of the Heart Sutra. And so just to kind of give you a sense of where this teaching of not self how it is embedded in the sutra. The first part of it reads as follows: Avalokiteshvara, while practicing deeply with the insight that brings us to the other shore, suddenly discovered that all of the five skandhas are equally empty. And with this realization, he overcame all ill being. "Listen, Sariputra," he said, "this body itself is emptiness, and emptiness itself is this body. This body is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than this body. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness." And so, stemming from this teaching, many Buddhist texts touch on the teachings of not self as well. So I have another text here, which is one of my, it's been a very important text for me, Norm Fisher's Training in Compassion. And he writes, when he talks about bodhicitta, he writes that bodhicitta is the feeling of love based on the deep recognition that what we call self and what we call others are designations, concepts, habits of mind, not realities of the world. What we call self, what we call other, not realities of the world. And then finally, another text, Mindfulness in Plain English by Bhante Gunaratna. He writes, "Mindfulness is non-egoistic alertness. It takes place without reference to self. With mindfulness, one sees all phenomena without references to concepts like me, my, or mine." Now the complexity arises, this teaching of not self isn't taught in a vacuum. And so because we experience global systems of domination and oppression, then especially among people of color, we often have trouble with this language of not self, in part because we deal with so much, not only language, but behavior that wants to classify us as invisible, and sometimes even not persons, non-persons. In many of our experiences, the teachings of not self that we encounter in predominantly white Buddhist spaces are linked with practices, again, that would be called spiritual bypassing. And so using teachings of not self to refuse to witness, to refuse to recognize the harm that these systems of domination can do, especially to the psyches and to the bodies of people of color. So I found a podcast called Intersections of Dhamma and Race, and there are multiple parts, but in part one, so there are several interviews with Black meditators about their experiences with specifically with racism in American contemplative spaces, and this is in the United States. And one of the interviewees was a practitioner and teacher named Joshua B. Alafia. Some of you may have heard of him. He's founder of Southside Insight in Chicago. And so the way he defines spiritual bypassing is he calls it a phenomenon where white identified practitioners use their spiritual practice to avoid facing any racism, sexism, able-bodied privilege, homophobia, etc., that one may harbor inside. So that's not only refusing to acknowledge the experiences of others, but it's refusing to acknowledge and turn that lens inward to recognize how a person, what a person might be carrying and attitudes that they might be harboring. And so Joshua says that he's heard white practitioners claim that because their spiritual practice is developing their inner core, they don't need to face these worldly issues head on. And this type of avoidance actually happens, it actually happens quite frequently. And of course, it can produce pain and anger among many Black practitioners or many practitioners of color. And so what Zinju Erdlin Manuel, she writes, she offered an article back in 2020 called Awakening Fueled by Rage. And she writes that because these Dharma spaces are often plagued by this sense of denial and this practice of spiritual bypassing, as a result, practitioners of color quickly learn that in our Dharma communities, we often feel that we need to wear a mask of politeness, of niceness to conceal this feeling of rage or this feeling of pain that we may carry. And she goes on to write that fear of rage causes some Buddhist centers to put Blackness or other forms of diversity on display, hoping to encourage other people of color to come in and participate. But then those in power often don't know how to create a genuine path of dignity and freedom that honestly acknowledges all parts of us. So on the one hand, the spaces, PWI Buddhist spaces may kind of want to emphasize, you know, their or encourage diversity to bring in more practitioners of color. But then once we come into the space, real damage can be done if teachers and practitioners don't know or not skillful at acknowledging, you know, kind of moving through denial and really acknowledging the pain that these systems create. And so kind of as a shorthand, I've come to call this this phenomenon whitewashed Buddhism. And it's not really about the color white, but I grew up on a farm and, you know, when we would whitewash our fence, whitewashing is just kind of it's a quick and easy way of covering over. You know, you give the fence a nice quick coat of whitewash and it spiffs it up, but it's not a repair. It doesn't kind of fix the wounds in the wood underneath. And so I also, in some of the research that I've done, I found some information by Dr. Angela Rose Black, and she talks about her experience feeling unwelcome in white mindfulness spaces, yet also feeling this intense and unwanted attention from white practitioners. And so I have a quote from her reflecting on her experience. She says, "I arrived in mindfulness spaces as a woman of color, already fatigued by racial isolation and racial aggression of the world, yet expecting and hoping to try on practices that might aid in diffusing some of the burden I carried. Instead, I had to navigate the complexities of feeling unwelcomed while curiously hyper-focused on, unseen, yet aggressively over-directed by white practitioners and teachers." And so another way of thinking of this is underrepresented and yet over-determined practitioners. And many, many practitioners of color find ourselves in this situation. And reflecting, once I started doing this research, I actually remembered I lived in Orange County when I went to school there for several years, for about 11 years. But when I first, maybe within the first year, I made a friend and I had an individual practice for about 10 years, maybe longer, but about 10 years. And I met a friend and she mentioned that she had gone to a temple in Orange County. And I asked her, I said, "Oh, well, that's great. You know, how is it? Maybe I can attend." And she reported one of these experiences of being underrepresented and overdetermined as well. And what she said was, "No, I wouldn't go if I were you." And she said she had only been a few times, but right away, the teacher, who was a white identified male, she was the only woman of color in the space, and he singled her out for additional in front of the Sangha for additional instruction in terms of how to sit. He said that she was not sitting properly, that she was not meditating properly, and that she needed additional instruction. And so what she told me was that made her feel unwelcome, and yet at the same time, hyper-focused on it. It made her feel like everyone is looking at her. And of course, with this stigma of you know, not practicing correctly. And this idea brought me back to Zinju Erthlin Manuel's book, Sanctuary. And she has a quote here about not being seen. And it's just very short, but she says, "To feel at home includes being recognized. Without being seen, we begin to disintegrate, and our ability to think, see, hear, and function diminishes as though we're dying. It's difficult to see yourself as whole when you're not acknowledged." And so I think this quote from her really, you know, sums up a lot of that experience. And yet I would say, I know through this practice that, you know, by making it our own and by making ourselves at home in our practice, we not only feel, you know, the deep contentment of being seen, we become better able to offer maybe more expansive, maybe more non-judgmental awareness to others so that they can be experience being seen as well. But before I move on, I just wanted to ask, you know, as I describe this experience, I was curious to see maybe with a show of hands, can you all raise your hand if you've experienced any of, if you've had any of that experience of not feeling seen or overly focused on? I see lots of hands. And so, you know, the more I've thought about it and the not only the more research I've done on it, but it makes me even more grateful for spaces like this, not because we have to create a bubble and stay there and avoid interacting with the rest of the world, but because those experiences can be so painful. And our spiritual practice should be, it's not that our practices are painless, but they should be places of sanctuary. Our internal spaces and our community spaces of practice have to become spaces of sanctuary if the practice is really, you know, to offer any kind of healing. And so I offer just in my heart right now, I offer strong metta. I offer compassion for all of us, for each of us who have experienced that sense of not being seen, whether it's in, you know, a Buddhist space or out in the world, you know, in everyday life. And so my more idealistic, optimistic side, though, and it's not idealistic because I've actually experienced, you know, the possibilities of this practice. And so I know firsthand the healing that can arise when we make our practice our own, when we allow it to become our sanctuary. And so I think an important part of making our practice our own is when we integrate or when we create rituals that, you know, that speak to our own cultural situatedness, that are grounded in our own experiences, that reflect practices that bring us joy. And that too can seem to be, that can create a sense of vulnerability as well. You know, when we are in Buddhist spaces and we wonder, you know, is it okay to pour libation, you know, before I meditate, or is it, you know, is it okay as though there are individual or there are kind of invisible Buddhist practitioner police who are going to say, well, no, you're not really a Buddhist if you pour libation or if you integrate a memory and a connection with your ancestors, you know, as part of your meditation, or if you pray as I do to the Orishas, kind of as bookends to your meditation, then you're not a real Buddhist practitioner. And so I think this idea of creating sanctuary is a powerful one. And that is actually, there's so much to that, that I feel that there's another, there's a whole other talk there, the rituals that we can create and that we do create to help bring us a sense of being seen and to help give us a sense of peace and serenity within our practice, because that I believe that's where the real healing resides. And so my experiences with this idea of being seen, when I remember the times when I have felt that I've been seen, they're also kind of couched in experiences of kindness and compassion, both feeling it and offering it. And so I wanted to give just a few examples because I wanted to also encourage us as a community to, you know, just as remember moments of not being seen, I think it's important for us to recognize moments when we have felt seen, and also to create practices and create kind of habits of mind, of spirit, mind, and body, so that if no one else sees us, we, you know, when we kind of turn that lens inside of ourselves, when we sit with ourselves, that we can feel a sense of compassion and love for ourselves. So one example that I wanted to share is I had a relative, and this was several years ago as well. And this relative is older than I am by about 10 years. And we were kind of making an intentional effort to become closer. So talking more on the phone and seeing each other because we lived in the same city. And at one point, this relative confided in me that they were having marital issues. And so, you know, over the course of several conversations, they started telling me about, you know, just some of the details and the fact that they, you know, they felt a sense of guilt, but they were also feeling a sense of not being seen in their relationship, in their marriage. And so that sense was, you know, kind of contributing to more distance growing between this person and their partner. And it was also contributing to a lot of guilt that this person was feeling. You know, they're feeling this distance, they're feeling unseen, and it became kind of a vicious cycle of feeling guilty for feeling unseen, feeling guilty for having the feelings that they felt, and also, you know, engaging in some behaviors that they were not proud of. And so, as I said, some of these conversations were on the phone and some of them were in person. And what I felt called to do was really engage in deep listening, you know, with my heart, just, you know, this is a person that I love. This is a person who's family. And so really I didn't, and I was, you know, surprised, you know, when a person kind of broaches this kind of subject with you. And I really felt, well, my duty here is really to first just to listen. I'm not, my place isn't to offer a solution or offer absolution, but really just to listen and then to start to ask questions, but really in the spirit of, you know, of trying to gain better understanding, also in the spirit of recognizing and letting this person know that I was hearing, you know, that they were in pain as well. And so over the course of several months, this began to play out, and I encouraged, you know, this person to definitely talk to other family members that they felt close to, because that their first impulse was to kind of say, you know, we have to keep this a secret. I have to keep this a secret and not tell anyone else. And so we talked about that feeling of shame, that feeling of guilt, and really worked through whether that was serving this person or not. But and they did. They brought in a couple of other family members that they trust. And it was maybe after a year, you know, they had been working on the issue with their partner, and I didn't broach the subject. We talked about lots of things, and that might be one of them. But after about a year, to me, it seemed to come from out of nowhere. And this person said, you know, I just want to tell you that you were really, I really appreciate you. And they said, you didn't judge me. You didn't, you know, try to tell me what to do. And you didn't make me feel bad about what was going on. And like I said, this person was older than me, is older than me. But they said they really, it made them look to me as a real source of support. And they really appreciated that. And I was really touched, because that was, as I said, I really felt honored that they confided in me. And so my goal, you know, I wasn't thinking I have to make sure they feel seen. I really just let my heart be open and listen. And I let love kind of be my orienting principle. You know, what if I asked myself, you know, what am I trying to do here? It was love. And I wanted to let them know that they felt loved, and I really felt the love coming from them, you know. So that was an that was an example of, you know, when according to this family member, they were helped to, you know, by being seen. And it actually did teach me, though, that by approaching a situation with the intent to listen deeply and allow my heart to be open, that can do so much good. It can contain so much power, even though that wasn't what I was, you know, trying to direct it. I wasn't trying to make that happen. A second example is, again, more recent. So just a couple of months ago, at the end of December, my sister passed away. And we hadn't been raised together our whole lives, but throughout our adult lives, again, we had been working on becoming closer, like intentionally taking time to be together, to get to know each other. And it really felt like a blessing because we were being intentional. You know, no one was making us spend time together. We were spending time. We would talk on the phone. We would go away for weekends together. We created a text chain between all of us sisters because we wanted to. Thank you for your compassion. And it was difficult in and of itself, but it was even more difficult because I was teaching a class. We have a Jan term here. So the month of January. So the class started January 3rd and my sister passed December 31st. And I so much felt that I just wanted to lay in bed. Teaching a class was the last thing that I wanted to do. It was the last thing I felt like doing. It was really difficult. And so I knew, and so I built into the syllabus, I knew that we would be having a memorial, a service for her. But when I found out when it was on a Saturday. So I built that into the syllabus that we wouldn't have class that following Monday. And I just kind of put class canceled. And I briefly explained it at the beginning of class. I said, you know, I'll be going out of town because of the death of a family member. And I was, you know, focused on being professional, on being, I didn't want to unload, of course, you know, my grief on my students. And so I thought I was kind of addressing the issue. As the semester, as the month of January continued, though, I felt so scattered. I felt as though I was definitely not, you know, living up to my high standard of teaching practice. I would forget to answer emails. I would forget to post readings on our website, things like that. And so when the memorial came, I went down to Southern California and I stayed at my mother's house for about 4 days. But even as I was at my mother's house, I was telling her, you know, I keep forgetting things. I keep I'm not on my A game. And I said this because, you know, we were talking, but I remembered there was something else that I, you know, needed to post online for my class. And so I whipped out my laptop and I was going online and I was like beating myself up. Like I'm just not doing a good job. And my mother's very no nonsense. And she's very much, you know, the kind of person like who might say, suck it up. Not, you know, to various situations, like that's the answer, suck it up. But what she did, she just kind of walked behind me. I was standing up on my laptop, just kind of berating myself. And she just walked behind me and she did this. She put her hand on my shoulder as she was walking. And again, she said, that said so much. And it offered me so much comfort and without saying anything. It let me know that she saw me. It allowed me to feel that sense of compassion, that sense of grace. And I was encouraged, you know, to give that grace to myself. And so what I did, when I went back and returned to class, I decided to tell my students that it wasn't just a family member, you know, it wasn't just death of a family member who passed. And so, and I was nervous because, you know, that creates a sense of vulnerability. And what I did not want was for my students to think that I was expecting or using that as an excuse for some, you know, for substandard teaching or something like that. And so at the beginning of the next class, I told them, I said, so I mentioned that I, you know, had the death of a family member. It was my sister. And I told them, so if I'm not answering emails as quickly as I usually do, or if I'm forgetting things, sometimes I just want to lay down and go to sleep or just, you know, cry. And so I apologize, but I wanted you to know. And I saw my students, I saw them nod, just that simple, you know. And there was a student who had emailed me before the class started saying, I just wanted you to know I'm coming from rehab. And so I may have, you know, just some difficulty readjusting, but I'm committed to doing the work. And I just wanted you to, you know, to kind of, I just wanted to reveal that to you so that you could be informed. That's what the student's email said. And I saw that student, especially, she met my eyes and I saw her nod and I felt seen. So, you know, these are just a few examples. I thank you. I thank you for, I do feel seen here. And I share these examples because I am, I think my baseline is pretty, it's not idealistic, not always idealistic, but it is optimistic. And so while it is important to recognize, you know, the pain that's caused by practices like spiritual bypassing, and the fact that, you know, when we feel unseen, or when we feel even worse, you know, kind of targeted negatively in spaces where we're supposed to be in spiritual community, that pain and that anger and that sense of alienation can be great. They can be huge. And it's important to not only to recognize it for the sake of recognizing it, but to recognize it, number one, so that we acknowledge that we are not alone. And number two, so that we can affect change, so that we can continue to move forward and expect our places of spiritual community, expect them to grow and to change and to rise to the occasion, moving through a sense of denial or a desire to deny the oppression and the hardship that we face, if they are really to live up or live into their conception as spiritual communities, inclusive communities, then they have to make that recognition, and we all have to do the work of affecting change, of recognizing what we can do, what we can bring to the table, so that our sanghas really are inclusive sanghas. So I'd like to, I offered those couple of examples, but I just want to allow us a moment as a sangha. Let's take time and reflect, and maybe we can have a bit of sharing. Whether it's a time where you felt you needed to be seen and you didn't get it, or a time when you did feel seen, where you felt that you felt that compassion and that grace and that deep kind of seeing into, you felt that someone was offering that for you, or a time when you offered that, because I think that's important as well. And so again, I go back to Zinju Erdlin Manuel's book. And so she says, taking refuge is the English translation of Sarana Gamana. Sarana in Pali means shelter, protection, or sanctuary, a place where safety and peace are possible. To take refuge in the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, is to follow a path that leads us home to who we are, a path of awakening. So I just want to encourage you all, and I send with sincerity, with all sincerity, I offer love and kindness, wishes for peace and positive energy, because we walk this path together. And as we do, and as we commit to this practice, we become more of who we are, and we offer sanctuary for ourselves and for one another.